And I warn you in advance, there's a lot of names just thrown in here. Don't worry about it, because they're just names of people and it'll make sense. But now in the Western battle, Fingon and Turgon were assailed by a tide of foes, thrice greater than all the force that was left to them. Gothmog, Lord of Balrogs, High Captain of Angband, was come, and he drove a dark wedge between the elven hosts, surrounding King Fingon and thrusting Turgon and Húrin aside toward the Fen of Sirich. Then he turned upon Fingon. That was a grim meeting. At last Fingon stood alone with his guard dead about him, and he fought with Gothmog until another Balrog came behind and cast a thong of fire about him. Then Gothmog hewed him with his black axe, and a white flame sprang up from the helm of Fingon as it was cloven. Thus fell the High King of the Noldor, and they beat him into the dust with their maces, and his banner, blue and silver, they trod into the mire of his blood. Now not only do I think that passage is very powerful, I think it is. I don't think you can deny that. And it's in a completely different style than modern 20th century literature, and yet it still worked. You can't point to it and say, oh, it's an imitation of X or Y. But also, Tolkien has caught some of the rhythms of Anglo-Saxon without stealing anything directly the way he did in some of his other works. So, for example, that line, "That was a grim meeting," echoes line 11 of Beowulf, where, after saying all these things that the great King Scyld-Scheifing does, the poem says, "That was God Kunning," that was a good king. It's not just an echo. What it does is it sums everything up for the reader. That's part of the oral tradition again. When a participant in the oral tradition hears something like, "That was a good king," it serves to close off debate. It says, this is what your idea of a good king is. When Tolkien says, "That was a grim meeting," it's the archetypical grim meeting. And it's also a nice little litotes, a deliberate understatement. It wasn't just a grim meeting, it was a hideous, bloody battle. But it's enough to say it in an understated way. You can get a lot of that from the Silmarillion. There's a lot of very beautiful, beautiful passages. Morgoth and the Ungoliant, the evil spider, looking down on the wheat of the gods as they're ready to invade. Or Beren cutting the Silmaril from the crown. Or Arendil sailing into the west. There are many, many beautiful pieces that Tolkien hadn't managed to stitch into a whole. And I think that that's why the Silmarillion is worth reading, because it's so different from any other kind of novel, any kind of writing that you would see before this. The fact that it got published as much by Tolkien's name and fame is really immaterial, because it suggests that there's a different kind of aesthetic that you can follow to enjoy fantasy literature, and it doesn't always have to fit into the mold of the modern novel. I think The Lord of the Rings does fit into the mold of the modern novel, with mediation of the hobbits, with all those interlaced techniques and modern narrative techniques that Tolkien uses. But it's important to allow ourselves freedom to look at different ideas, and the Silmarillion allows us to do that. That's why I recommend reading it. Now we're going to move in the next lecture from Tolkien the artist to Tolkien the critic, and talk about how Tolkien was so influential, not merely because he created great and popular art, but because he gave all subsequent critics a new way of looking at that art and a way of talking about it that was able to break free from kind of the hegemony that the Henry James followers have had over fiction for a very, very long time. And although this hasn't yet completely crossed into mainstream, it's at least making some inroads. So we're going to look at Tolkien the critic, both in terms of a critic of a medieval literature, but more importantly, as a critic and a supporter of fantasy.
This ends Lecture 8.